Welcome to this episode of our special podcast series, a collaboration between ASTCT Talks and Cancer Network. In each episode, we dive into the latest developments and challenges in the treatment of multiple myeloma, T-cell malignancies, and other pivotal topics in oncology, hematology, stem cell transplantation, and cellular therapy. Join us as we speak with leading experts, uncover new research insights, and tackle key issues facing healthcare professionals today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of ASTCT Talks. On behalf of the ASTCT Content Committee, I'm delighted to have you join us today. My name is Dr. Talhal Johashi. I'm an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Oklahoma College of Medicine and the associate director for the transplant and cell therapy program here at OU Stephenson Cancer Center. We're really very excited today to have Dr. Nora Gibson. Dr. Gibson, or Nora, is a fourth-year fellow in bone marrow transplant and cellular therapy at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She has a lot of expertise in clinical research and epidemiology, really focused on curative therapies for hemoglobin disorders. We will discuss with Nora her abstract titled Post-Approval Real-World Experience with Beti-Cel for Transfusion-Dependent Beta Thalassemia. Nora presented this work at the annual Tandem meeting last February. Nora, thank you so much for joining us today. So excited to discuss a really important and very timely topic with you today, gene therapies in the real world setting.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here and to discuss this, my favorite topic.
Wonderful. So I'll jump right in then. Nora, can you tell our audience and teach us what exactly is Beti-Cel and what types of gene therapies are currently available for patients with hemoglobin disorders and in particular thalassemia? And if you can highlight any differences that help us understand these therapies.
Yeah, absolutely. So Beti-Cel also goes under the trade name Zynteglo, and it's an ex vivo autologous stem cell product, which is used to cure transfusion-dependent thalassemia. So the way it works is stem cells are mobilized and collected from patients with thalassemia. And then with Beti-Cel, a lentiviral vector is used to insert a modified functional HBB gene into the patient's cells. And then the patient goes on to receive conditioning chemotherapy. The cells are infused back into the patient, and the patient is then able to make normal hemoglobin A with some slight modifications. And so this product was FDA approved for the cure of thalassemia in February of 2022. And it can also actually be used to cure sickle cell disease with the same mechanism under the trade name of Lyfgenia. This is one of two commercially available stem cell therapies for thalassemia and sickle cell disease. The other product is known as Exa-Cel or Casgevy, and again, effective for both sickle cell disease and thalassemia. So similar to Beti-Cel, the patient has stem cells mobilized and collected, but the product actually uses a different technique to modify the cells, which is based on the increased production of fetal hemoglobin. So there is a gene called BCL11A, which is on chromosome 2, that functions, among many other jobs, as a silencer of fetal hemoglobin outside of the neonatal period. What Exa-Cel does is it uses CRISPR-Cas9 technology to edit the erythroid-specific enhancer region of BCL11A and allows for the production to resume of fetal hemoglobin. And then when cells are infused back into the patient, again, after conditioning chemotherapy, patients can then make a lot of fetal hemoglobin, which is enough to counteract the disease phenotypes in these hemoglobinopathies. So patients with thalassemia are no longer transfusion dependent after receiving either Exa-Cel or Beti-Cel. There are a number of other gene therapy products for hemoglobinopathies currently in clinical trials. One notable example is the Beacon study, which is for BEAM-101. This is specifically for sickle cell disease and uses base editing to disrupt binding of BCL11A, the same gene, to its promoter. So the idea here is that there would be uninhibited production of fetal hemoglobin, but without compromising other functions of BCL11A. So many other products currently in clinical trials. It's a very exciting time for these things.
Yeah, I agree. Really, this is really amazing. So much research are happening now in gene therapies for these hemoglobin disorders. I guess my follow-up question would be, has there been any big clinical differences between the two technologies that you've mentioned, one that focuses on addition of a functional beta globin gene versus the second technology that really focuses on increasing the levels of HbF in the blood?
Yeah, we have not seen functional differences either in clinical trials. It's a little too early for us to do comparative analyses of beta cell and exa-cel. We at CHOP have done more transplants with beta cell than exa-cel just as a function of contracting, honestly. But it's a little too early for us to really do head-to-head real-world comparisons. In the clinical trial, they were fairly equal. And, you know, I can get to this data in a little bit, but generally, we consider the transfusion independence rate for both products to be about 90% in transfusion-dependent thalassemia.
Wonderful. Yeah, of course. Very effective products for sure. And so, which brings up my second question. How does this treatment compare with other non-curative therapies like allogeneic stem cell transplantation? Obviously, there are a lot of other drugs in development for thalassemia too. So how do you see this compared to the other things available?
Yeah, so I think there, from a transplanter point of view, there are a couple of differences just in how this is administered. So both gene therapy through autologous stem cell transplant and allo stem cell transplant both require the intensive time in the hospital. Patients who are getting beta cell or exa cell, they are getting the autologous stem cell transplant. And for them, the process and lead up time to this transplant is much longer. So several months before they get the transplant, they have stem cell mobilization. In the case of transfusion-dependent thalassemia, they have plerixafor and GCSF. Sickle cell disease, we only use plerixafor. They have a central line place. They're admitted for apheresis, and this can last anywhere from 1 to 3 days. And then the cells are sent for manufactured. And that whole process between scheduling apheresis, occasionally patients have to undergo more than one cycle of collection. That takes several months. And then the cells are sent to the manufacturing facility and the processing there also takes months. Once the cells are successfully modified, patients are then admitted for conditioning. And that's where they start conditioning chemotherapy with single agent busulfan. And the goal here is to myeloablate the bone marrow in preparation for receiving the modified cells. In autologous stem cell transplant for gene therapy, our goal is to essentially make space in the marrow for these new modified cells, as opposed to many of the immune-modifying agents that are also used in allo stem cell transplant. But I would say, as far as efficacy, as I alluded to earlier, we say generally 90% of patients who are getting beta cell or exa cell achieve transfusion independence. And there's quite good long-term follow-up data. It was actually presented at ASTCT earlier this year that shows persistent transfusion independence about 10 years after therapy in patients who received the earliest versions of beta cell and exa cell. Beta cell actually was that data only. So for allo stem cell transplant, as I said, the lead-up time to getting this curative modality is much shorter because you don't have to go through the apheresis and collection and mobilization process. So this is a very well-studied therapy. It started in Italy in the 1980s. We have a lot of follow-up data. And so that's been historically one of the major benefits, is that we know 30, 40 years later how these patients are doing. We say that, you know, in general, MASH-related donor transplants for thalassemia have graft failure-free survival rates above 90%. Generally, most of these patients don't have a huge problem with GVHD. Most of them have excellent durable transfusion independence. And the benefit actually of doing a MASH-related donor transplant over gene therapy, if you have that option, is that they can then receive a reduced intensity conditioning regimen under most circumstances. We use CAMPATH, fludarabine, and melphalan. And so this tends to have a better side effect profile than busulfan-based myeloablative conditioning that we would need to use for gene therapy. And so we would consider patients with a MASH-related donor, we would generally consider that a very well-studied and excellent option, and probably the preferred curative modality. But the problem, as we all know, with allo stem cell transplant is most patients don't have the benefit of a MASH-related donor. And so the optimal alternative donor transplant modality is still very much an open question, and there's been some debate about that.
Well, no, absolutely. So let me ask you this then. So at your center, do you guys assess the patients for both of these treatments, or you favor one versus the other, or how do you approach this in everyday clinic?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a CureED clinic, which is a curative therapy for red cell disorders clinic, where patients see a hematologist, a transplanter, a fertility specialist, a social worker. So it's a really multidisciplinary approach. And the way we tend to approach things is before the patients even come in, we tend to do HLA typing if we are able to. So we HLA type the patient. If they have any siblings, we will often HLA type the family members just so we know kind of what options we're looking at. And we'll actually even run an unrelated donor search for these patients just to, again, see what our options are here. And the way I tend to approach it is at these initial visits, patients often don't know a lot about gene therapy. So I present both allogeneic stem cell transplant and gene therapy options. And my discussion really depends on if the patient has a matched related donor, often we will discuss both options, we will often say that the match related donor transplant is probably the better studied option, but we wouldn't unequivocally make that choice. So I think we tend to present both options, but knowing that we have a little bit longer follow-up data for MASH-related donor transplants, that ends up being what we tend to favor. Unfortunately, most of the patients that we see just don't have a MASH-related donor. So we are not often in the situation where we can have such a wealth of options.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, a lot of the times it's not either or. You find yourself limited to one versus the other. And you also brought up a very crucial thing about all these therapies is really the long-term toxicities, especially the fertility and cardiovascular and secondary malignancies. So a lot of these things need to be obviously looked into and will help us decide in the future. Which brings us to your really amazing presentation on this topic at Last Tandem. So can you please tell us about, you know, what your abstract was about and what you found and your experience, your center's experience with gene therapy?
Yeah, absolutely. The work that I presented at ASTCT this year was an analysis of 10 patients who underwent autologous transplant and then received beta cell after commercial approval. And so we had a median of about 12 months of follow-up for these 10 patients. And I would say just to give the main points, overall, these results are very promising. All of these patients became transfusion independent and at the time of the abstract and still maintain that transfusion independence. So 8 out of these 10 patients only needed one collection cycle, which is exciting to know that we can collect adequate cell volumes in one cycle. The other 2 patients mobilized well, but had unsuccessful manufacturing, so had to repeat that collection cycle. And then in terms of the product health, they had excellent CD4 positive cells, cell numbers in the product, and adequate vector copy numbers as well. And as I said, after infusion, all of these patients achieved transfusion independence in a relatively short span of time, about 33 days was the median. And so one thing that we did look at was that patients take a longer time to engraft their neutrophils and their platelets than we would expect to see and have seen institutionally in our allogeneic transplants. So in the cohort that I presented, we saw a median of 27 days for neutrophils and platelets of 50 days. I would say, you know, I can go into a little bit. We have some work and thoughts on why we are seeing these, but I would say overall, despite this long engraftment time, these patients all ended up being discharged in a reasonable span of time and are doing well in the outpatient setting.
I see. Well, then let me ask you this. Since there is a significant period of wait time between, you know, collection and then cell manufacturing and then infusion, what do you guys do with the patients? How do you keep them ready and prepared for myeloablative chemo and then stem cell infusion? And I guess that period varies a lot too, if you can comment about that too.
Yeah, it's a highly variable period. And that's one of the issues that we've struggled with. It's often hard to know how long it will be because it depends on manufacturing date, collection dates, things like that. Typically, we maintain patients on their standard, for thalassemia at least, we maintain patients on their standard transfusion therapy. One of the issues that we have encountered is if they are requiring increased transfusions, especially in preparation for collection, we want to make sure that their iron is appropriately controlled with chelation. And so sometimes it can be a balance of ensuring that they are getting adequate chelation, but not having additional organ toxicity from the chelators in this scenario. So they, I would say overall, our standpoint is to maintain our standard of care, but it can be really difficult and challenging for families to plan, you know, life events when we don't know if they might need to be admitted in 6 months or a year or a year and a half or things like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Going back to the issue of acute toxicity, sounds like engraftment was one of them. Did you guys see a lot of infections, and how difficult were those to get controlled? And I know the abstract mentioned also at least one case of veno-occlusive disease too of the liver.
So we, in terms of toxicities, one of the major benefits we've seen with gene therapy is these patients do beautifully and have not had major infections. We've had a couple of cases of flu, the occasional line infection, but really not much in the way of infectious diseases or in terms of noticeable viral reactivations. The issue of veno-occlusive disease is kind of tied in a little bit with the prolonged platelet engraftment. We have, of the 10 patients I presented here, three did have veno-occlusive disease. And I will just comment that none of these patients had, at the time of infusion of stem cells, had particularly high iron. So this was not really a factor or not a difference between those who did and those who didn't. So it's unknown essentially why these patients got VOD in terms of risk factors. We would not have thought that they were particularly high risk. But all three of these patients did have severe disease, either required a peritoneal drain or required defibrotide, but ended up recovering well. The toxicity that we have seen most often, and this is kind of tied in again with VOD, is bleeding, particularly in patients who have HLA alloimmunization prior to transplant. And we are still working out the pathophysiology here, but we have found a noticeable link and association between patients who have very high levels of pre-transplant HLA alloimmunization and this very prolonged thrombocytopenia that we have seen in some of these patients. And this is true in both our clinical trial patients and our commercial therapies. So some of these patients who have panel reactive antibodies in the 90s to 100% have taken not just above the median of 50 days, but 90, 100 days to engraft their platelets and have required many, many platelet transfusions. I think our highest was like 116 platelet transfusions. And we have seen that some of these patients have had quite severe bleeding. We had a patient with a subarachnoid hemorrhage, was intubated for airway bleeding, and required intensive care. So these are not insignificant side effects that we're seeing as a result of these periods of prolonged thrombocytopenia.
I see. Well, good to know. And as you have already mentioned, it looks like all or most of the patients are still transfusion independent, and they have noticeable improvement in their hemoglobin levels. Did you guys see any relapses since the time you've reported on your,
No, we have seen all of these patients have gone on, and we've added a couple more since this was published, and we have seen truly excellent results. All of these patients remain transfusion independent, hemoglobin generally in the 11 to 12 range for most patients, and they are all doing great so far.
Oh, that's fantastic, really. I'm sure like they're very happy. What are your key take-home messages from your work? You're already an expert in this field, and this is a very new field for a lot of us. So what do you want our listeners to take home with them after listening to this podcast? And how do you counsel patients? Now we have a lot of therapies available, to treat thalassemia, sickle cell, and hopefully many more diseases in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really exciting time to be working in this field where we finally have really good options for these patients. I would say overall, from our experience and from clinical trials, beta cell and likely exa-cel, though our experience is more limited, are very, very effective curative therapies for thalassemia in the real world setting. And we've seen very similar results in sickle cell disease. These therapies have been really life-changing for our patients, and they've had a huge reduction in their symptoms, a huge reduction in their burden of healthcare that's required. I think, especially in thalassemia, where we're seeing these trends, as we're counseling patients in the pre-transplant setting, we need to be very upfront about bleeding risks, especially associated with this HLA alloimmunization. So at CHOP, what we have started to do actually is to screen all of our patients for HLA immunization before they're even consenting to treatment. Because, you know, if there's a possibility that they could have very prolonged thrombocytopenia and even dangerous bleeding, we want them to be aware of this up front and to be able to potentially even mitigate this alloimmunization before they go to curative therapy. So I think that's our biggest overall hesitation and where we see the most toxicity. But I would say, you know, we are starting to encourage most of our patients with transfusion-dependent thalassemia to go this route and at least undergo an assessment. And I think, you know, for all of our patients and providers that treat them, I think it could be beneficial for everybody to have at least an assessment to kind of see what options are out there and what might be possible for these patients. Yeah. So still much to do, but it's a really exciting area.
It is exciting indeed. Any final words on specifically the fertility risks that happens with these patients? I'm sure you get asked this a lot.
Yeah, I think the way I tend to phrase it, because I will be very honest that we don't have great long-term follow-up data on fertility, specifically in patients who've received single-agent busulfan. And especially in terms of transplant outcomes, much of the fertility data is on patients who've had malignancies and may have a different risk profile for fertility challenges. So the way I approach it with patients, because, you know, it's often a prescient risk factor, I tend to say that, you know, we know that busulfan especially impacts fertility. It is not impossible for patients to have a successful pregnancy or to father a child as well, but it is likely that they will have to have reproductive assistance in these scenarios. And the way our multidisciplinary clinic works is that they give patients an upfront idea of what options might be available. And we have great partnerships with surgeons and proceduralists who are able to do some of these fertility sparing procedures. It is hard in this scenario to give an idea of how likely it is, even if with these fertility sparing procedures, that they may be able to have a child later on in life. But I think it gives patients options and a good chance, hopefully with technology advances in the future, that they will be able to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. And really so much to learn about these new therapies. It's this exciting time for sure. Well, Noura, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck really with the rest of your fellowship.
And thank you.
And as we wrap up today's episode, I want to sincerely thank all of our listeners. I hope you found our discussion today as insightful as I did. I really learned a great deal about the very interesting topic, gene therapies and hemoglobin disorders. And until next time, this is ASTCT Talks. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode. We hope you found our discussions enlightening and relevant, offering you a deeper understanding of the present and future of cancer treatment and research. Make sure to join us again for more insightful episodes as we continue to bring you expert opinions and the latest developments from the forefront of oncology and hematology. Please subscribe and leave reviews wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more. For additional resources and episodes, visit our websites at www.cancernetwork.com and www.astct.org.